It has been 13 years since the world nearly split in two.
Those of us that knew of the cataclysm at the time have tried to move on. However, as the lines between worlds started to thin again, it was only ever a matter of time before something terrible started to pay attention. But who will stand at the gates for us? Why, four employees at Thorn Investigations, of course.
Least I can do for, you know, all that you do for me.
My reflection looked back, distorted.
There's absolutely nothing normal about this.
This wasn't right from the start, so why don't you tell me the bits you're leaving out?
The Thorn Files is a Monster of the Week actual play podcast, perfect for fans of mind-bending mysteries and terrifying monsters. We have new episodes coming out every other Friday, and you can find us on whatever podcasting app you use. Join us for our new season in January 2025, or if you'd like, go listen to our first season. Whatever the case, we'll be happy to have you. Just be ready to be scared.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, a show where I chat with other creators in the TTRPG space about how they run their tables. I'm Danger Dan Jers, the GM and host of D&D Dark, and joining us at the table today is an actor, editor, film enthusiast, and player in the Monster of the Week podcast, Oddity Roadshow, Shannon Strucci. Hello.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. To get us started, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your history with the TTRPG community and, of course, about Oddity Roadshow?
Totally. I am a professional video editor. That's like what I do for money. I would like to continue doing it, but I used to do video essays, so on like film theory, film history, and I also used to cut short comedy films for this old, like there used to be in Atlanta a sketch comedy competition called Ladies Night, and it was run by three guys, and one of them was this guy, Joel Ruiz, and we became friends, and then in 2018, he started an actual play podcast called Critical Bits. It was using masks, which is like a Powered by the Apocalypse teen superhero system, and he put a lot of like political ideas and body horror into it on top of masks, which is doesn't really have that as much. And Joel and I became much better friends over time. And Oddity Roadshow is another show of his that started two or three years ago when he put me on that as well. Through my video essay work, I used to panel, like before I had a full-time job, I paneled at a ton of conventions. So I've done some tabletop live shows with Authors and Dragons, Critical Bits, and Oddity Roadshow. So I've like done live actual play performance, which is really fun. And I've done these two shows with Joel, which are both like long running, heavily edited. Like, I mean, they're comedy shows, but they're also like more serious and there's emotional investment. And I've done a lot of random guest spots on streams. We used to do a lot of charity streams. Like I helped run stuff for like Make-A-Wish or Covenant House, Georgia. We would do tabletop stuff on that. I had played D&D before, but I only really started getting into tabletop around 2017 with a offline Dungeons & Dragons campaign that I really enjoyed. But I got into actual play mostly because of Joel, or entirely because of Joel. And then I transitioned that into some like voice acting work and have just really, really super enjoyed it. And I hadn't really, like, I knew I could be a funny editor, but I didn't necessarily consider myself like funny in conversation or funny on mic. And he really believed in me and encouraged me. And I've gotten way better at that over time. It's really cool. It's like I've had people cosplay my characters or like write fan fiction or get, we don't have like a huge audience, but we have a very committed audience, which is really awesome. And I never want to take that for granted. Which is interesting because my video essay work, the thing that I spent the most time on and that I'm most known for was a series on how terrible parasocial relationships are.
Well,
yeah, which is, I mean, it's fine if it's like with a fictional character and not necessarily focused on me.
Yeah.
Like getting invested in the character is fine, but I tried to like have at least somewhat of a barrier there, though that's like a daily struggle with this kind of thing. And Oddity Roadshow is a Monster of the Week series set in the American South. So it's like Southern Gothic, dark comedy, body horror, these like young adults graduate college and go on a road trip in a magic van and are kind of discovering themselves. And I play like kind of an unhinged gay con man who at the beginning of the show made a deal with a demon and has 6 months to live. And it's like developing his character arc has been super fun and like trying to give him a face turn and trying to make him a good person and dealing with backsliding has been like super rewarding. And the fans seem to enjoy it. So it's been a really cool, really cool process. And it's like, I love editing, but this has been such a good creative outlet for me. Because editing is creative, but a lot of what I do is more corporate. So this is like super fun.
Yeah, it's a great medium to explore creativity in. And like you were saying about how it's really useful for opening yourself up and giving you practice and becoming sharper, quicker, funnier.
Yes.
I love the concept of your character, especially for a Monster of the Week show. It fits that subgenre and niche very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
I want to pick your brain a little bit about that. Can you go into a little bit more detail about, as much as you are willing to, you don't necessarily have to spoil any major story beats, but your process in developing that, your mindset, and how you've approached the character, and if it's changed over time?
It's been super fun. And a lot of stuff where it's like, I could talk about it forever. To where even like fans of the show, I don't know if they'd still be interested. But I've always really liked trickster characters, con men characters. Better Call Saul is one of my favorite TV shows. I love Reagan from Mob Psycho 100. Incredible character. Very fun. And Lupin the Third. I've been a Lupin fan for like 20-something years. Specifically, Lupin in the movie Mystery of Mamo was a really big influence on how I play Marlon, my character. Over COVID, like over quarantine, I also got really into the music of Will Wood, who is this like...
Ah, yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've Man is my favorite band, and they heavily influenced Will Wood's music. But he... And not saying like this is like one-to-one with my character, because I don't experience these things, and I don't want to like try to be representing something that I'm not... Like, that's not part of my lived experience. But from what he said in interviews and in his music, he's either like bipolar or has borderline personality disorder, and he has a lot of like addiction problems. And a lot of the music is about first, like, hitting rock bottom and dealing with that and processing it. And, like, am I my actions? Am I a good person? And then his more recent album, In Case I Make It, is very much about atoning for that or, like, figuring it out or being like, hey, I'm only human. I would say, like, I have my own problems, but my behavior is not erratic. Like, I'm not a very reactive person. And I wanted to play that. I told Joel when we were developing the character, I was like, Marlon is someone... Where if you get a character to like make him angry, he's going to key their car like immediately. He's going to be extremely reactive to where, because Kim, the character I played on Critical Bits, our first show, is much more like me and just like very level-headed, slow to react, hard to get under her skin. And I was like, I want to play the opposite of that and just really have fun with it and make him so, so petty and so reactive in a way that I'm not. But also make him tenacious and likable, at least on and charming on some level. So that's not a totally, especially in something like actual play. I think if I was writing a novel, I would have made him a little bit meaner or a little bit harder to. But in actual play, like I don't think anyone would have liked the character if I had made him like a real life con man. And something that has been a big part of his arc that I can go into a little bit without totally spoiling it for people who might want to check out the show is at the beginning of the show, I had Marlon go off and make phone calls and send a lot of letters and do weird, shady things. And then I would not explain what he was doing. And I think it's episode 31, first watch. A friend of the show, Evan Brando, came on and he was basically a rival con man who had really hurt Marlon in the past. So Marlon was like hellbent on ruining his life, like legally filing that he was dead, sending clowns to his mom's funeral, just like doing all of these like really horrible, like weird, aggressive. I was like Googling revenge plots. And also Evan's character, Christian, is like, he's more handsome than Marlon. He's more charming. So Marlon just like fixated on him and hated him. And there was also some like tension between the two characters, like unresolved feelings or whatever. Evan does come back on later. And I think it takes like a really interesting form, the way that that happens. But it was like, this has been a way for Marlon when he's feeling helpless to feel in control and to just like, well, this guy did this one really bad thing to me. So I get to keep like needling at him forever and being confronted about that, like reaping and sowing. That was so fun. And that's one of my favorite episodes. Part of Marlon's impetus as a character as well is that someone died as a result of one of his cons. Then he can't really fix it or undo it. And he feels guilt about it. And I think that also makes him more sympathetic that he's not like a monster. Because I talked to Joel and I kind of wanted like a neater redemption arc to that. And he's like, no, this is bad things happen and it's your fault sometimes and you just have to deal with it. And I'm like, okay, that's really interesting. So that's also part of the character. But a lot of it specifically is Will Wood's music and Lupin stuff. And there's also a book I would highly recommend. There's a really interesting woman named Maria Konnikova. Who she like decided she wanted to play professional poker and learn how to do it and then did well at it. But she also wrote about a book called The Confidence Game, which is about the process of con artists, the process of a con. My only complaint, it's like very America and Eurocentric. And I was really interested about con artists in other cultures because, of course, what they do is going to be different. But it's a really good book. And I listened to the audiobook and that was also like learning about the process a lot. It was really interesting to me. So And then just trying to give that character like some level of emotional depth and having fun with all of his different like aliases. And the other two characters on our show are much more naive and like friendly and playing off of that as like the face, but the evil face at the beginning has been really fun.
It's fun. It's a tricky balancing act. An interesting thing that I've found with actual play as a medium is it's really difficult to effectively pull off subtlety. That's where more morally ambiguous characters can be tricky to navigate at the table, because a lot of like internalization and subtle character work tends to get lost and buried. And where the line is of how much is too much is really hard to decipher sometimes, especially if it comes at the expense of the other players. It's fascinating when I can see it done effectively. And I really enjoy seeing more nuanced portrayals that land. It's a struggle that we've gone through a little bit with our own show. So for context, for the general conceit of season one of our show is it's a 5e actual play where the cast of characters are the classic universal monsters. The bard of our party was the Phantom of the Opera, and he goes on a series-long redemption arc. Early on, his character was a little more polarizing, but he very quickly became one of our most popular characters. It took about 5 or 6 episodes before he started playing him more comedic, let some of the wind be taken out of his sails, and became a bit more of a punching bag for the team. And it took buying that goodwill for him to eventually go to the darker, more abusive and manipulative places of the character that he wanted to explore from the outset. That was real rough, but is some of the best work that we do within our show. And he absolutely has a phenomenal arc. I did also not that long ago in my home game, I played an evil character for a Tyranny of Dragons campaign, and playing an evil character that is selfishly motivated and at odds with the party was fun to a certain extent. And then we had to, at about the halfway point of the campaign, we had to kind of stop and recalibrate with the group of like, okay, let's redefine where the line is and how to navigate this so that we're not at odds with each other anymore. Because it is just a really tricky balancing act. So I really commend you for taking on that big of a bite going into it. It's phenomenal when it works. It can be so tricky to maneuver effectively.
I think one thing that helps with Marlon is that he's kind of a loser and falls on his face a lot, like constantly.
Helps so much.
It's less like what you were describing. It's not as much like goofy slapstick. He's just so angry. And like Paul Byron is one of my co-hosts, and he plays a Chosen, and he's like a himbo, and he's so handsome and everybody loves him and he's oblivious to it. So, of course, Marlon is like seething with jealousy all the time. And there's a scene where Marlon sees like 100 mirror universe versions of himself, and immediately he's angry because they're all more handsome than him, but they look just like him. He just perceives himself like that's a prison of his own. It's an unpleasant place to be. And we actually had not the opposite problem, but I remember a fan saying all the characters were cinnamon rolls, or like one just had less icing or something about Marlon. And I was thinking, he's a bad guy at this point. He is not. It's like, I'm glad he comes across as charming or whatever, but it is a hard line to walk because you don't want to put people off. And that's really interesting what you said about kind of like buying goodwill by making it a little bit sillier and then going into those things. And I think the way I handled it was making him like really pathetic at times, or it's like, oh, he's really good at conning people. But then if you actually know him, he's like a very sad person. And by developing real friendship, it's like the very shonen anime, like power of friendship, by developing these actual relationships and kind of looking out for these other more naive characters and figuring out how to navigate what's happening with him and the rival con man and being like, oh, I can't just keep trying to ruin this guy's life. That's really, my friends are like looking at me weird when they find out that I did this. Like, oh no, I need to stop. It was more fun than anything. And I think too, it was easy for me because he had done bad things that had really serious consequences. Like his best friend at the beginning of the show is essentially a supervillain, and he just kind of ignored all of the killing and like all of the terrible things. But Marlon never, I wouldn't say he was necessarily like overtly abusive in a realistic way. That would have hit more close to home. That would have been harder. If I was like writing a novel or telling a more serious story, that's something I would be willing to explore. But in this, it was like, no, there was definitely a line, and I stayed on the other side of it.
Yeah, leaning into shortcomings and inadequacies, I think, does so, so much. Aaron is the player who was the Phantom. A lot of where the goodwill he bought came from is that he has the worst dice luck of anybody at the table and is really, really good at playing into and playing up failure. So that went a long way. The fact that he's funny also buys a ton of goodwill. It's interesting how much I've found my audience will forgive characters if they're funny. Probably the single most hated character in the show is Dorian Gray. The actor who plays him is fantastic and hilarious, and all of the above table banter with him is great. His character is deathly serious and is reviled. It's an interesting discussion I've had behind the scenes with some of the cast. Bailey, who plays Dorian, hilarious. They love him. They hate his character, which he did a really great job of immediately making himself detestable. And part of it, too, is similar to what you were going into with Marlon and the rival con man. It's a thing that I, as a GM, have done multiple times is I will bring in a guest specifically to be a foil to one of my party members, who is a similar build with better stats.
It's so fun. It's so much fun.
And so far, it's been a success every time, and it always leads to some really great, fun dynamics. It's so interesting navigating that space, and it's something that I'm going to be working on as a player a little bit more. There's some bonus content that we're doing where I am going to make an effort to play a not necessarily evil character, but a character who backslides into morally reprehensible territory. So navigating that tightrope is something that I am keenly interested in, especially at this current moment.
Yes, it's a lot. But yeah, and I don't fault anyone if they're just looking for more like morally uncomplicated escapism.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
never something I'm interested in playing, but on Critical Bits, the superhero show, Joel would do these every year. He'd do this special called Spider Day, which was about like the anniversary of a giant spider attacking the town, and the superheroes tried to beat it. They all got killed, and it got killed by a second larger spider is the whole conceit of it. And in one or two of the Spider Days, we played a group of villains, and I was like, I'm playing the arsonist who is an arsonist. And my whole thing was that I would just set stuff on fire, and like my worst enemy was a firefighter that I like kidnapped, and there were like all these and like in an actual show, a long running show, that would be terrible. I think it would get old really fast. But in like a 2-hour thing, I was just like trying to maximize the humor and just really have fun with it. And that was really fun. But that's like, it's also playing to the space that you have to play around, and like a one shot is very different, or like an over the top. It's like everyone in this is going to die, so I might as well. It doesn't matter if this person's likable. It's just let me have fun, get some laughs out of it.
Yeah, the change in stakes in doing shorter form content changes so much. It gives you a lot more latitude, and it makes it more freeing to make those kind of big swings. Another interesting kind of discussion point that we bring up every once in a while when comedy bits come up behind the scenes as things that we might integrate into the show, and stuff that's in the back of my mind that I know is in the back of a couple of players' minds that we've brought up is this a joke that can sustain itself for 5 minutes or 5 episodes or 5 seasons?
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting what changing formats will give you the leeway to do.
Absolutely. And I think kudos to Joel, who runs the show. Like, he had like a really, really rough life when he was a kid, but he was also super into like LARPing, and he did stand up for 10 years and just kind of has a really good instinct for like, whether it's NPCs or like what we're doing, like a jokes. There are some running gags for sure, but a lot of stuff is like, okay, we did that this episode, then we won't do it anymore. I think we throw stuff away faster just because we're more comfortable and like confident in what we're doing, which I think comes with experience. Or like a lot of our guests are like, I've barely done any improv, but they're very experienced improvisers, and it's like a lot easier for them to kind of know like, oh, we don't want to drive any of this into the ground and try to come up with new things. And like at the beginning of the show too, Marlon had like a phobia of birds, and Jamie is the other main character. She's like a horse girl who's like very naive, and she gets possessed by essentially this like creature that looks like a cassowary, like a really scary bird. So for a while I would have Marlon freak out every time she transformed, but I just kind of, I don't know if it's like a plot hole. I was like, this isn't working. It gets kind of fun at the beginning, but then I was like, he doesn't really need to be scared every time or he would get over it. So I just like intentionally dropped it.
Yeah, that's one of the benefits with my show is that there are pros and cons to being both the GM and editor of the show.
Mm-hmm.
It is a recipe for burnout, but on the plus side of it, because I am also editing the show, I, as a GM, can clock into really quickly what is working and what isn't working because I'm exposed to it over and over again. And since I'm the one putting it together, I've got a little bit more freedom and latitude to be able to pick and choose and be able to clock and let people know in the moment of like, you know, I think we need to approach this differently. We should drop this or keep going. I don't tend to edit in real time very often. My group has very good instincts, so I'm very, very happy with a lot of where they tend to take the stories, and it's very rare that I will intervene.
Mm-hmm.
But that is one of the perspective things that I get as being editor of the show that helps out a lot with that kind of thing. But yeah, absolutely. Doing this with time, we've gotten better and better at it. We've gotten sharper with our improv skills, and we do much more situational comedy than anything else. Running jokes tend to be very organic when they pop up. We don't usually outset with jokes in mind. And if we do, those tend to be the ones that don't work.
Oh, that's interesting. Like in retrospect, you're like, oh, we shouldn't have done that.
If you're trying to force it, it tends to fall on its face. It's usually the stuff that comes up in the moment that tends to get a lot more mileage. And I don't know if that's just our own personal shortcomings or if that's part of the medium, but I do think the organic nature of stuff that happens in the moment definitely has that more genuine feel. And I think that's a big part of why some things work and others are less effective. But anyway, I do want to circle back around to Oddity Roadshow. So one of the other aspects that I want to pick your brain about, both because it's interesting and also some selfish reasons, since your show takes place in a fictionalized version of the United States, how does drawing on the real-world locations of the American South influence the show? And how has your perspective on those places changed by proxy of doing the show and blending that realism with the more fantastical elements?
So I'm from Georgia, and Joel, who is the GM, is from Chattanooga. Joel and I think our families are like Southern. So like, my childhood vacation spots made it into the show. All of the road trip stops were not planned out ahead of time. I'm sure Joel had like certain things planned out, but early on, especially, we would finish an arc and then he'd be like, okay, here's a list. So we would choose where to go based on that or pitch things. And there were just like really, really weird places that I don't know if I realized they were weird when I was going there as a kid. Like in one of the Carolinas, there's a theme park called Santa's Land that's like Christmas themed. And when I would go like in the early 2000s, like 90s, early 2000s, it was super rundown and creepy. Like the animatronics were really creepy. And there's a zoo where it's like, I'm sure it's not the best. Like the animals are not taken care of the way that they could be. And I had an experience where I was like 10 or 12 eating a sundae and they were feeding the baby bears. And one like grabbed my hand and shoved it in its mouth to like lick the ice cream off. And everybody freaked out, but it was fine because it was just a bit. It's like these weird memories. And like, this is such an interesting place. And there's also, we set a big scene for Marlon in this place called Babyland General, which is in North Georgia that I also grew up going to, which is a Cabbage Patch doll. Like there's a tree in it where they're birthed out of this big tree. It's like, it's 100% real. It's very weird. And we've played a little bit with like aspects of Southern culture, like weird evangelical stuff. Some Southern cultural tropes. Although Marlon, in honor of Maria Konnikova, whose book I love so much, The Confidence Game, I made him Russian. So I didn't have him be culturally Southern, which it'd be fun to explore in the future, you know, but he still like grew up like in the South and like playing on that. Or we set the first arc in Dalton, Georgia, which has like carpet factories. And Joel came up with this thing where there are like evil worms in the carpet factory that are eating people or whatever. And people get possessed by worms.
As they do.
And, you know, Dalton, it's just, that's how it is. Joel had this character, his friend Claudia might have come up with him. We called him the Fulg, which stands for fucked up little guy. And he was essentially a trucker who had been like done every kind of drug and been cursed by all sorts of different creatures to where they canceled out. And he was like basically immortal. So Joel played this like very kind of like manic, weird character who Marlon, he ends up getting the Fog's hand. So he'll be like periodically possessed by the Fog. And he also kind of looks like the old cereal mascot that looked really crazy.
The honeycomb creature. Whatever the hell the honeycomb thing was.
So he's like a evil Southern trucker man. And I think from my perspective, like I said, I don't have a ton of an accent and I work in like film stuff, which is not that related to how I grew up. But like my family's like very, very Southern and Joel's Southern accent is very authentic. And like the cultural pulls are very authentic because we're from here and all of us like live in Atlanta as well. So that stuff is very fun. And I don't know how much it's changed my perspective on these spots because I had such a history with them. But your question reminded me of on Critical Bits, our first show, Corn Dogs, became like a really big plot point. And there was like daycare was like the evil organization putting something in the corn dogs. And we had a lot of European listeners who were like, what's a corn dog? And I was like, whoa. I thought like everybody knew what a corn dog was, but no. So we would like explain it, or like people would, or like Sonic was a big part of it, Sonic Drive-In, and people being like, what, that's real? I thought that was just in the show. That was interesting because those things I didn't think were that weird the way that I think like Babyland General or Santa's Land are. So getting a perspective from outside of my culture on Critical Bits in particular, but that was fun. That was really cool. Whereas in Oddity Roadshow, the things are kind of like self-evidently weird.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so interesting what you take for granted as like a region specific staple. I've got family that live kind of all throughout the country, mostly in either the Northeast or the Southwest. It's really interesting anytime that we are meeting up, either we are going to them or they're going to us, and trying to figure out like, okay, what are the little things? For example, I live in California. It was a thing that took me by surprise the first time that I went to the East, but that I've clocked now since, is I try to pay attention to what is the architecture like in any given area. Because that's one of the big differences. When I went to go visit my sister in Chicago recently, I brought my partner with me, and she was surprised that everything was brick. In California, we've got everything is more or less stucco, and everything is built specifically to withstand earthquakes. So stuff that is meant to withstand wind and water is always a little fascinating to us, because we live in a part of California that is not desert, but desert adjacent. And she grew up in the desert. So completely different types of weather considerations. A lot of regional chains either go by different names or just don't exist. I remember when visiting my sister in Chicago for the first time, wanted to stop at a Culver's because we don't have that over here. And frozen custard isn't really a thing in the Southwest. And I love frozen custard. So that was a big important thing. And like getting that in cheese curds, that's also non-existent where we are. So it's really interesting what stays the same and what changes from place to place. And like another thing that we take for granted is we call the freeways and highways by different things. We refer to all of our highways as the blank freeway, the 91 freeway, the 10, the 101. And that was a thing that threw me, was the difference between that and interstate number. So we are going to I-90, 70, etc.
One time I was paneling at a convention in like Baltimore. It was like lunchtime and we were getting free lunch there, and there were sandwiches, and they were asking if I wanted like white bread or wheat bread or potato bread. And I said, oh, I'd like the potato bread, please. And he was like, whoa, potato bread, you're not from here. And I was like, I didn't even realize I said that in a way that was like revealing of where, because I didn't say potato. I said potato, like just a Southern thing. Like with Sonic in Critical Bits and Oddity Roadshow, the big like reveal confrontation episode between Merlin and the other con man, we ended up setting it at First Watch, which is like a breakfast chain that might be local to the Southeast. So like Waffle House is obviously like much more known now and very beloved by like Southerners, and it's kind of a meme. First Watch is definitely more upscale, and it just became sort of an in-joke, and then the episode got titled First Watch, and then people are like, oh my gosh, I went to First Watch from Oddity Roadshow, which is funny because I really like First Watch, but it's not like culturally significant to me. It just has like a good breakfast like menu, like the juices are good. And we ended up a lot of the episode being like, oh yeah, the juices are really good here. They have so many different types of bacon, as like a running joke. And then fans like that. But that one, like I said, that one was funny, especially because it's not like the way I grew up going to Waffle House, and it's like kind of an equalizer because it's like affordable. It's open all the time. And I had multiple family members who worked there who had these crazy stories, because like a lot of the times Waffle House would pay in cash. So a lot of people who worked there had like addiction issues, or there would be fights or so on. Whereas First Watch was just like, it just became an in-joke just in that episode. Or like we mentioned it a little bit, like in the episode where Evan comes back, it comes up a couple times as a joke. But that's another one where it's like, we didn't talk about it for a long time. So it's funny how those things, how meaning gets attached to things. And it's not always in proportion to how much you personally love it. It's just what's funny or what works for the characters in the moment.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see how that kind of stuff changes with context. So using that as a jumping off point to transition to my next question, from your experience doing Oddity Roadshow and interacting with your fans and in the various capacities that you've played in the TTRPG space, how has this show recontextualized TTRPGs for you as a whole? And are there any lessons that you've learned from Oddity Roadshow that you've taken with you into other TTRPG projects or even beyond the TTRPG space? Is there anything that you've learned from the show that you've brought into like your editing work or other acting endeavors and the like?
I mean, the biggest sleep up for me was doing Critical Bits, because I had been on mic a lot as like doing voiceover for video essays and being interviewed on podcasts, but specifically to talk about video essay topics or to talk about like film theory, horror theory, these sorts of things. And Critical Bits was like, oh, acting might be fun. I had acted a little bit in short films, but like, oh, this might be fun for me. And then Oddity Roadshow was like, oh, I can actually really work at this and get a much bigger emotional range out of myself. And it's made me more confident in my acting ability. Simultaneously with working on Oddity Roadshow, I took a 101 improv class to try to stretch my abilities or whatever. One weakness of mine that I have gotten better at is, like I said, I'm a pretty like level-headed, reserved person. So I'm not like naturally wacky or spontaneous or like super, like if I'm put on the spot, it's really hard for me to come up with like a joke just like that. Just like any kind of like wacky, goofy, like vulnerable, silly improv, I don't enjoy it. It's kind of like scary for me. So like that was my way. Taking that class, I was trying to come out of my comfort zone. I'm still bad at those. I've gotten better, but I'm still bad at like being that kind of like silly vulnerability. But in that class, it was so interesting to me that like any moment that was more character or story motivated, I was a lot better than some of the other people there, just because I had so much experience. Like I can immediately get into character and do these things. And like if I have this logic to base it on, I feel like I'm not just okay at it, like I'm pretty good at it because I have so much experience playing these different characters. And it made it a little more comfortable for me. But then I was like, yeah, I'd hate just straight improv. I would hate doing this on stage where I have to be like, oh, make up a joke about a lemon. I'm like, everyone's saying all the good ones. I'm like in my own head. And like when you're at the table, you can pause for a second and that can be edited out, or you can try something. And if it doesn't work, you can redo it. Or like when I'm doing a live TTRPG show, I can be entertaining there, but it's like it's because of the character. Or what I love to do on the Authors and Dragons shows, John Hartness would just kind of put me on when we were at the same cons, even though I'm not an author. And I would always play like a Circle of Spores druid, because I would be like a normal druid for the first 30 or 45 minutes and then be like this disgusting like fungal creature, and the audience would freak out, and it's like you'd only know if you knew. And then that was really fun. But I think Oddity Roadshow has pushed me a little bit, both to be more comfortable being emotional on mic. I think I've gotten some good. There was stuff with my character in Critical Bits that fans said they like cried at, which was cool, but it wasn't really necessarily me. It was more the situation. And I think I've gotten a lot stronger at that. And we do follow the rules of Monster of the Week, but we got a lot of complaints on Critical Bits that we didn't follow the rules of Masks exactly. And it's like, well, we're trying to tell a story. So I don't know if it's necessarily influenced how I look at the mechanics of TTRPG at all, but I think it's helped me get more comfortable in my performance. Like I have an off mic game with my friends where I play like a Columbo rogue and do a Columbo impression. And I would not have been able to do that like 5 or 6 years ago. I would have been like, oh, it's embarrassing. And now I just have fun with it. So
that's fantastic. And I get exactly what you're saying about the like particular nature for the rules. I specifically say in our introduction that we are loosely based on whatever system we are running, just because we do incorporate a heavy amount of homebrew. We also get rules wrong all the time. We've caught ourselves on it a few times, but there are some things that I didn't notice until the show was over that like, oh, we I was doing that completely wrong. And our fans have generally forgiven us for that because we put that little disclaimer at the beginning, and they understand that the story and the humor of the moment takes precedent for that. But improv training is interesting, especially because it is so varied.
Mm-hmm.
Dramatic improv is a very underrepresented field that I think really takes hold a lot in actual play settings. And I much prefer long form improv over short form for a lot of the same reasons and a lot of the draws that TTRPG and actual play tend to have. You have the time to really flesh things out a bit more. Things tend to be a little bit more grounded because there isn't the time pressure. And you can usually get more depth and mine some more interesting ideas when you've got the proper time to explore them. Not to say there's anything wrong with short form. Short form is really good for helping make you quicker on your feet. And there's a thing that I saw in an interview the other day. I can see his face. I can't remember his name. But it was a musician and stand-up comedian who says that you can actually train yourself to be funnier and quicker on the fly. And the thing that he does is he will, for a designated amount of time per day, sit with an encyclopedia, flip to a random entry, and then free associate until he has something that would be a decent stand-up comedy bit, write it down, and then be done for the day and move on. And doing that repeatedly got faster and faster at it. Those connections come much more readily, tend to get funnier and funnier bits from it just from practicing that targeted free association. So it is interesting, and that is one of the benefits of, you work a similar muscle doing short form improv. It is definitely not for everyone. I think it's better as an art form to do than it is to watch.
I like being on stage and I like performing, but I am an extremely reserved, shy person. I don't like a lot of attention. We did a live show in Atlanta before COVID that was really cool for Critical Bits, which fans drove a couple states to come to.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it was so cool. There are these really wonderful, committed people that we were very lucky to have be a fan of that show. The tone is very different from Critical Bits Oddity Roadshow. So I think we lost some fans, but not in a way where it's like, because it's like Critical Bits was more like teen superheroes fighting fascism, and Oddity Roadshow is a lot more like murky and adult.
It's a different genre.
It's a totally different genre. The tone is different. The performances are different. Where Ladies Night had shown that sketch show I mentioned, it was like an improv theater in Atlanta called the Village Theater, where we held the live show and we were just kind of like setting up. And Joel looked at me and he's like, people are going to start coming in soon. Do you want to go hide backstage? And I said, yes, I'll talk to them after the show. That's how shy I am. Something that helped me too is very much being put in the deep end is on both shows. I've had the opportunity to work with really, really, really skilled improvisers and kind of see what they're doing. Like we got on Critical Bits, we had Mark Muir on. He voiced Commander Shepard.
Oh, awesome.
And he also, I went and saw his one-man show that was Fear and Loathing and Lovecrafts, where he was playing with all these different tropes, and he'll do live D&D shows in Atlanta sometimes. He's Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
He was a space sheriff and my character had blown up his jail, so he was chasing me. And Joel played his drug addicted space gun. And that was being so thrown off the deep end. I did my best, but it was hard to keep up with him. And I'm longtime friends with Branson Reese, who runs Rude Tales of Magic. And him coming on, and he played this chaos monster. And that was also very fun. And it's okay, I have to try to keep up with this. The most, not emotionally challenging, but the most technically challenging episode of Audio Roadshow for me that I wish I had done better on, but it was just so outside of my wheelhouse, was we had an improvised musical episode where we had Chris Myers, who is a very wonderful local actor. He's been in some TV shows and stuff. And he's a part of this. I think he had done some musical improv locally. He's also a part of a show in Atlanta called The Tipsy Zone, where a bunch of improv artists get drunk on stage and improvise Twilight Zone episodes, which is amazing.
That's fun.
It's so fun. I like watching improv. It's so good. And they're all really good too. I think I like stand up more than improv for the most part, unless it's really good improv, then it's the best thing ever. So it was him and Rachel Frawley, who's a local actor as well, came on, and they can both sing and improvise really well. And we did a ton of songs. I forget how many we did. And we had a keyboard artist, Theodore Hobson, who's awesome. So we just we're doing improvising entire songs on the spot, which is so uncomfortable for me. And I did okay, but it was watching them do it and how clever they were and how fast and I can't sing either. It was super fun. And if you're ever in Atlanta and he's on a show, you should go see him. He's fantastic. But yeah, that was like terrifying. And it's the same kind of anxiety I got when I did the improv class of like just being put on the spot and trying to come up with something creatively. Whereas my process when I do video essays or whatever is so meticulous. Our editing is inherently, it's like sculpture. It's such a meticulous process of like adding and removing frames and all these adjustments. And you spend 100 hours on something and then you present it to people. Something my instructor emphasized a lot in the one improv class that I took was like, you're fine. Nothing bad is going to happen, especially in this classroom. You could fail terribly. And then there are no consequences. So it's like, but it's just like an aspect of my personality that I don't know if I'll ever be able to fully change to be comfortable with being like really, really wacky.
It's definitely a tricky hurdle to get across. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the, when I was doing improv in high school and college, that is like one of the fundamental lessons of improv is being willing to accept the risk of failure, because the risk of failure is what makes it intriguing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why when improv is really good, it's like a magic trick. The really good improv only comes from the big risks. And it's that like high risk, high reward kind of situation that you get the best bits out of.
And I think specifically with tabletop, you need a really good GM to help that balance. Cause I've definitely guested on shows.
Absolutely.
Or especially, you know, as like an AFAB person, people will like talk over me or just like, and it's like, if you look at all of our waveforms comparatively, I'm talking not very much. Cause I also don't want to step on toes, but if I'm given that space or if I'm comfortable, something I think I do pretty well on Critical Bits and on Oddity Roadshow is like playing the straight man in some situations, or generally like setting other people up for good jokes. I think some of that is coming from like having, my family is like super loud, super funny, like super outgoing Southern people. And being friends with comics over the years too, it's like, oh, I don't have to be like a wallflower or something. It's like more fun to like riff and set people up and think of like what would be a good story beat for this character. And I remember what I was going to say earlier too. It's so interesting how different stand-up and improv are, because I've never done stand-up and never wanted to do stand-up, but there was a period that was very formative for me from like 2015 to 2018 where I didn't have a lot of work or a lot of money, but I had a lot of time. So I was going to like every stand-up show in Atlanta. And to this day, a lot of my like best friends are stand-up, are mostly ex-stand-up comics from the city. And something that I observed there that I also observed kind of like growing up online. And when I was, and I'm pretty open about this too, like when I was younger, I'd post on like more edgelordy forums, and there was that particular culture, which is very similar to stand-up culture, of kind of like crueler comedy and like individualism. I did a video essay a few years ago about like how to get funnier. And what I had observed and what I talked about in the video essay is like, if you put yourself in an environment where being funny is rewarded socially or with grades or whatever it is, and being unfunny is punished socially, you will get funny faster as like a survival mechanism. Whether that's doing stand up on stage or if it's like socially where like if you tell a joke and it doesn't land, but that's like the opposite of improv, because improv, you want to be able to go with anything regardless, and everyone's really nice and everyone's very supportive. But that's what makes a bad improv show so excruciating, is because it's so sincere and everyone's doing their best and I just can't handle it. I'm like too empathetic or whatever. Whereas like bad stand up, it's over in 5 minutes and it's not, there's less on the line, it feels like, because there's less of an emotional. I mean, I started going to stand up shows in like 2012 or 2013. And so I've watched some people over 10 years and the way that they work and the way that they improve, like Tevin Williams, who goes by Mandel, we shot a lot of stuff together. He's done a lot of stuff with Joel, and he was just on Fallon, and he's like one of the funniest, most like amazing. And I'm like beside myself, happy for him, and like watching how hard he worked. He did seem like someone who was naturally funny, but the way that he worked at it is like so cool and so admirable. But yeah, I just improv and stand up are both comedy, but they could not be more different. And I think taking a lot of lessons from hanging out with stand ups helped my performance too. But it's like the opposite lessons that you learn, and it's a lot crueler. I don't know, but that makes it less painful to watch.
Yeah. Improv being largely group based and having a team to fall back on changes a lot of the dynamics. Like, for example, you bring up that one of your big strengths is in setting people up and being the straight man. That is invaluable in a group setting. And I have nothing but the biggest admiration for the people that can fall into that niche. And that's something that I try to strive for. I tend to have more success as a GM than as a player. And part of that's just structurally that you can spotlight people better and make sure that people are getting the appropriate amount of attention and are set up for success. But being able to clock that and assist your fellow performers is the best skill you can possibly have in this medium. So I commend you for that.
I just feel fortunate that it was kind of my place socially anyway, because I had so many funny friends and stuff.
So to circle back around again one more time to Oddity Roadshow and to throw critical bits into this, what do you consider the best starting point for anyone wanting to check out your work? Is there a particular episode that stands out above the others? Is there a good arc to jump through? Does one project more so than the other better represent you?
If you want something really short, or relatively short, Joel did like a video miniseries called Avarice Hotel. And I'm in one, it's just like three episodes. They're like a couple hours each. It's about this like haunted hotel. He played Killer Ratings, which is a really fun TTRPG. And I play on that one, I played a much more like ethical character. I like playing con men and like cowards and stuff. And I played a much more ethical character, although he was a disgraced professor because he was obsessed with ghosts and he got caught grave robbing and is like trying to find a new lease on life doing a ghost hunting show. And it ends like really terribly for him, but that's really short. And there's a video aspect of it. So you can see me and everyone else, like our facial performances, which I think can add a lot to it, especially certain scenes in that. And I think Oddity Roadshow on the whole is better than Critical Bits, just because we're more experienced performers. Although we did have one, Shelby Lee left, not because of anything bad. She just decided she didn't want to make content anymore, which like good for her.
Very fair.
Yes. But also Critical Bits, like I said, it's more like, there's still adult humor and adult elements, but it is very much like we're teen superheroes and we're going to fight fascism and we're going to overcome this. And it's like finding your way as a teen. And we like a lot of those types of tropes. And our characters, I think, were more just based on us as people, which is a trap that I will not fall into again emotionally. You know, it helped in some ways. And in other ways, I was like, oh, I shouldn't have done this. And Oddity Roadshow is much more like adult. There are a lot more like sexual situations and humor, which we avoided playing teenagers. And it like we were pretty open. It's like, please don't sexualize the 17-year-old I'm playing based on myself or whatever. That's weird. Whereas in this show, it's fine. There's much more an aspect of it. It's a lot darker. And it's a lot more about the characters' kind of like individual struggles with themselves and with their environment. And it's a lot. It is more like a Supernatural or an X-Files versus like a Teen Titans. Like those. That's how I would differentiate. And for Critical Bits, my favorite episode was Hoagie Allen. Branson Reese came on. His character's whole thing was a witch cursed him. And until he learned his lesson, he would still be cursed. And he refused to ever learn anything. And he was trying to kill Paul's character. And it was so, Branson is just like an incredible comedic mind and so fun to play with. He's also on Oddity Roadshow as part of this like ghost hunting group called the Hellblockers. And I think my personal favorite Oddity Roadshow episodes are the ones where my friend Evan came on as the rival con man. So that would be episode 31, First Watch. If you just want to skip ahead, it's episode 58 or 59. The episode's called Edging. That's the one where we resolve that plotline. And like a really weird, you're going to get a lot of spoilers and stuff. But I think playing with like different tropes and the emotional resonance of it, I think is strong. The musical episode, I forget which one, but it should be easy to find. I thought was pretty impressive. And we have an episode called Ruby Falls, which is set in Ruby Falls, which is like a tourist trap in Tennessee that I liked recording it. Fine, but I was surprised like fans put that as like one of their favorites a lot. So those are the ones I would recommend. But yeah, Hoagie Allen is crazy and the stuff that the character work I got to do with, especially we became much better friends in between those episodes. So I think we wouldn't have been, that's something too that I learned is that I always want to try to be able to perform with whoever, but like having a foundation of like knowing someone well and trusting them made it a completely different, like I was friends with Evan when we did the first one, but like we hung out way more in between. So I think the follow-up episode was stronger.
I agree with that 100%. There's something to knowing the strengths of the people that you are performing with so that you can more adequately set each other up for success. That really helps with time. I strive for that with every group that I play with to try to really get to know and form a good connection with the people that I'm playing with for that same purpose.
And also knowing someone well enough, like obviously stuff like safety tools, like lines and bells are really important. But if you really know someone's like pain points or someone that you know well enough to talk to after if something upset you, I think it makes me feel way more safe than like a stranger I'm playing with who is really good about safety tools, but I'm like, on paper, it's not the same as direct interactions.
It's hard not to be more guarded.
Yes.
With somebody that you're not well acquainted with.
Because I care so much about when I'm playing, like not ever upsetting anyone or say, or being able to explore these like darker topics in a way that's not going to be triggering for anybody. Or, you know, there was an episode of Critical Bits where Paul's character had lied and my character got really, really upset, but like quietly upset. And afterwards, Paul was like, "Are you mad at me?" And I was like, "No, I'm sorry. I promise I'm not mad. It's just the character. Like, I'm not." And I wasn't screaming or anything, but I think it was intense enough to where he wanted to check in. I was like, "No, I promise it's okay. Sorry, I need to." And it got me more in the habit of like before or after shows being like, "Hey, this is just the character. I'm not. We can stop." Because I hadn't even thought like, "Oh, it would be like intense enough where he'd be like, 'Are you okay?'" I'm like, "Yeah, it's fine. It's fine."
That makes me think of, for me, with our show, there's a bit near the end of the show where the main antagonist is pushed a little bit too far and blows up and goes ballistic on the team. And as I was in the middle of having that meltdown as the character, I was typing into our Discord chat, "Oh God, is everybody okay? Did I cross any lines? Please don't let me go too far here."
That's awesome.
Anyway, that more or less comes to the end of my questions. Before we wrap up, are there any other miscellaneous things that you want to add? Any topics that we didn't cover that you want to make sure get addressed?
There's not a lot I can think of. Sometimes on Blue Sky, I'll do threads where I ask if anyone wants to talk about or wants advice on actual play podcasting. So if anyone wants to look those up and ask me, like, apart from obviously like inappropriate personal questions, ask me anything about it. I really like talking about it because I feel very, very fortunate to have like a creative career, and most people who know me are going to know me from video essays and from like a much more serious academic, like instructional standpoint. And I think a lot of them are like, "Why is Shannon talking about actual play again? I don't care." You know, but then the people who really like it ask really interesting questions, and I have so much fun talking about it. And it's my little, like, not little, but like my creative thing. And I want to say to anyone else who's doing actual play, it can be so disheartening because it is such a saturated market. And I know that like what we're making is good. We work really, really hard at it. Joel really heavily edits. He pays for like custom music and like spends so much time on sound effects and editing things down. And I put so much into like researching characters and planning emotional things. And we do have like a steady, the Patreon, I think, covers rent for his studio, which is awesome. But it's like, man, I wish, it's so hard to get it to people and to get like whatever, not that I'm entitled to a bigger audience, but versus YouTube, it didn't feel as much of like a fight for me or these other things. So like, don't lose hope and try to find joy in the act of making it versus, because I see a lot of people get disheartened and a lot of people have trouble because they kind of have a mindset going into it of like, "I'll record this fun game with my friends and maybe we'll get famous off of it." It's like, you got to do one or the other. You got to either make your art, your self-expression thing that you love, or you're trying to make money and get famous. Because if you're trying to do both, you're going to, and we're trying to ride that line, focusing more on the art aspect of it. And it's been not necessarily a struggle, but it gets so disheartening and so frustrating. So just like stick in there or find a different reason to do it.
Oh, yeah. It takes so long to build momentum in this medium. And so much of it is based on word of mouth. You absolutely have to do it for the love of the game. Otherwise, you will either burn out or make a subpar product or both. And if you want to actually finish it, it has to be something that you are doing out of enjoyment for the thing itself.
Or like be really tactical in how you approach it and not burning out. Because I think we spend so much work and so much time on it in the hopes of like it getting bigger. And I think if, especially Joel is so driven in what he's doing, I think he'll eventually, I mean, he's been doing this for 7 years, you know, if he was doing something more like palatable or more like if we played D&D or if we only got like, if we tried to get the most famous people as possible on all the time, then maybe that would have been something else. But yeah, I think you have to love what you're doing and find joy in it. Because I quit doing YouTube because I couldn't pay rent off of it. And now I want to get back into it, but as like a side hobby, which is crazy because it's like something I felt like I was like, it was very meaningful. It meant a lot to people, but it's like, it didn't, I was like living with relatives when I was 30 and I was like, I hate this. So don't fall into that trap.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll go ahead and close things out there, as we're going, can you drop any social links and like anything you want to promote?
Do You Validate is Joel's podcast network. So if you follow that on, he left Twitter for reasons, but anyone can guess probably. He's on Blue Sky and on YouTube and stuff. And if you just Google Oddity Roadshow or Critical Bits, you know, anywhere you get your podcast, you can find those. The musical episode is like, there's a full video edit of all of us sitting around singing. Avarice Hotel is also very easy to find on Google. If you look up on YouTube, Strucci Movies, Strucci, you can find my own video essays. I did one on D&D a long time ago and the comedy one and other ones that I've done. I would highly recommend Rude Tales of Magic. A bunch of the Rude Tales people have been on, but especially Carly, Tim, and Branson have been on our show a bunch. They are wonderful. I've recorded a voiceover for an upcoming game called Blank Sword, which is going to be super cool. RPG about like angels and like, I don't know, Google Blank Sword and you can find it. All this stuff should be very easy to find. I'm on Blue Sky. If you just type in Strucci, Strucci, it's either I'm talking about like getting migraines or vegan food or actual play podcasting or usually are the things. I don't get embroiled in like arguments with people or follow that much stuff, but that's what's fun for me to talk about. So.
All right. Well, thank you for all of that. I will be putting those links in the description. So, thank you again for coming by and chatting with me. This was a ton of fun.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
And thank all of you for listening. So one more time, everyone, I'm Danger Dan Jurs, the GM and host of D&D Dark. I've been chatting with Shannon Strucci, and this has been Table Talk. And I hope you enjoyed what we brought to the table. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Table Talk, created, hosted, and edited by myself, Danger Dan Jurs, with artwork by Jordan Nelson. Our guest this episode was Shannon Strucci. Links to her work can be found in the episode description. If you're interested in being a guest on the show, reach out to us at dndarkpodcast@gmail.com. Our theme song and outro was created by Jeremy Vellucci. Check out more of his works on Instagram at jeremyvellucci_wreckoftime. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time we have a guest take a seat at the table.